I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's August 1st, and we have a lot to talk about. When people think about MS symptoms, they might think about mobility issues, fatigue, that pins and needle sensation in their arms and legs. But they often overlook speech and swallowing problems, which are actually fairly common MS symptoms. The ability to speak is something so basic to our day-to-day lives that you may not even stop to consider it until you realize something about your speech is changing. And swallowing is something that's so unconscious, we take it for granted. Until, that is, something changes and you find yourself choking on a sip of water. Like many MS symptoms, speech and swallowing issues can often be well managed. And joining me to discuss some of the most common speech disorders people with MS might encounter, and how working with a speech pathologist can make a real difference in tackling those speech and swallowing issues, is an internationally recognized medical speech-language pathologist and multiple sclerosis certified specialist, Dr. Marissa Barrera. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Barrera, there are a few other things that you should know about. Several neurological diseases have symptoms that look like MS, and that can lead to misdiagnosis, which means that some people are told they have MS when they don't, and others are told they don't have MS when they do. In 2019, Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles and UCLA reported that 1 in 5 patients who had been referred to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center's MS Center or UCLA's MS Center over the course of just 1 year had been misdiagnosed. Think about what that means. Imagine spending years on a disease-modifying therapy that you never needed in the first place. Or, knowing how important early intervention can be, imagine not receiving that DMT when you did need it. Misdiagnosis has negative consequences for everyone. So last week, an international group of MS experts published detailed, updated recommendations on how to distinguish MS from other neurological lookalikes. The MS Differential Diagnosis Consortium, led by the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis, published this guidance in an effort to reduce the time spent to confirm an accurate MS diagnosis. And if you'd like to review this updated guidance, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Reducing the time it takes for someone to receive an accurate MS diagnosis means that they can start a disease-modifying therapy sooner. And that's important because it's been shown that early intervention leads to better patient outcomes. But results of a small study show that following an MS diagnosis, receiving approval from your insurance company for the disease-modifying therapy that you and your doctor have agreed upon is far from automatic. The study focused on 52 individuals who had been diagnosed with MS over the course of 1 year at an MS clinic. Following their diagnosis, their treating neurologist prescribed disease-modifying therapies that required prior authorization from their insurance companies or, in some cases, from Medicaid. Of the 52 prior authorization requests that were filed, 50% were initially declined. The odds for approval of oral medications or DMTs that required an infusion were significantly lower than they were for injectables. And of the 26 prior authorization requests that were denied, 21 received later approval after the treating neurologist filed 1 and in some cases 2 appeals. The reasons for the initial denials that were given by private insurance companies and Medicaid were step therapy, criteria not met, and non-formulary. So let's quickly talk about each of those. Step therapy is a practice of starting on a milder, less expensive medication and waiting until that medication fails before stepping up to a more expensive medication. And just to be clear, the evidence that a medication is failing is when the patient experiences additional disease activity. When it comes to multiple sclerosis, the fault in step therapy is twofold. First, it takes the job of prescribing the best medication to suit a specific patient out of the hands of the neurologist and their patient, and instead puts it in the hands of their insurance company. And the second fault is that there's growing evidence that shows that early intervention with high-efficacy disease-modifying therapies, and these tend to be more expensive therapies, well, that early intervention may be more effective at managing MS, reducing symptoms and delaying disease progression. So, in my mind, step therapy means we're waiting until you get worse before we really do something about your MS. And that's an unfortunate philosophy. Moving on to criteria not met. Well, this is almost a catch-all phrase that insurance companies use to deny coverage. It means that the insurance company does not believe that there's a medical necessity for a certain procedure or prescription. And non-formulary indicates that the disease-modifying therapy being prescribed is a drug that the insurance company has chosen to leave off of the list of medications that they'll cover. That list is called a formulary, and how that formulary is created is a deep, dark secret that insurance companies never share. This small study is interesting and unfortunate for a couple of different reasons. It's worth noting that in the end, 90% of the prior authorizations filed by the treating neurologist were ultimately approved. But filing prior authorizations and then filing one or more appeals adds a significant administrative burden to that doctor's office. Other research shows that a medical office typically spends 30 hours a month filing prior authorizations and appeals. So when we think about the cost of healthcare, we need to factor in this sort of hidden expense. But the more important and more unfortunate aspect of this situation is that additional disease activity occurred in 38% of the patients whose prior authorization was initially denied, compared to additional disease activity occurring in just 7% of the patients whose prior authorization was initially approved. Simply stated, this is unacceptable. And that's why our advocacy efforts are focused on issues like outlawing step therapy. The results of this small study serve as a sad reminder that policies that serve insurance companies and not patients can actually endanger the health and well-being of those patients. Hopefully, this initial study will inspire a larger study that analyzes the impact of prior authorization on disease activity among people living with MS. And PS to the insurance companies, increased disease activity means increased utilization of healthcare services over the long term, and that should worry insurance companies. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. In episodes 303 and 304 of Real Talk MS, we shared a number of conversations that I had during the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Congress that took place this past June in Vienna. The Alliance has published a report summarizing the key topics that were presented and discussed during the Scientific Congress. And if you'd like to review the report, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Now, if you happen to have the Real Talk MS app installed on your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet, you'll find a copy of that report waiting for you under the bonus content tab. And speaking of progressive MS, it's worth noting that speech and swallowing issues are symptoms that are often associated with advanced, more progressive MS. Joining me in a moment to talk about some of the most common speech and swallowing disorders that people with MS might encounter and how those symptoms can best be managed is speech-language pathologist and multiple sclerosis certified specialist, Dr. Marissa Barrera. So Speech and swallowing problems are fairly common among people living with MS. Speech disorders are estimated to affect about 40% of the people living with MS, and dysphagia, the medical term for difficulty swallowing, impacts about a third of the people living with MS. Dysphagia tends to be more common among people with advanced MS, and symptoms of dysphagia can include difficulty chewing or controlling liquids in your mouth, food getting stuck, or episodes of coughing and even choking when you're eating or drinking. Joining me to discuss some of the most common speech disorders people with MS might encounter and how working with a speech pathologist can make a difference in tackling speech and swallowing issues is an internationally recognized medical speech-language pathologist and multiple sclerosis certified specialist, Dr. Marissa Barrera. Dr. Barrera serves as the Assistant Dean of Health Sciences, as well as a program director at Yeshiva University's graduate program in speech-language pathology at the Katz School of Science and Health in New York. Dr. Barrera is also a member of the National MS Society's Clinical Advisory Committee, and she serves as a distinguished faculty for the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Barrera.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to share my passion for speech and swallowing with all of your guests today.
When people think of MS symptoms, they might think of fatigue, that tingling pins and needle sensation in their arms or legs. They might think of mobility issues. And while speech and swallowing difficulties may not be on that same list, they're fairly prevalent among people living with MS, aren't they?
Absolutely. I think when we think multiple sclerosis, you're right. We often gravitate towards challenges with ambulation, fatigue, heat sensitivity, and those are all extremely valid and important symptoms that need to be managed from the get-go. But believe it or not, challenges with speech, swallowing, cognition, these are not uncommon. We see about 49% of individuals living with MS experiencing changes in cognition. A very conservative number of speech and swallowing, and this number varies, can be anywhere from 40 to 60% in terms of changes in speech and swallowing disorders, and a multitude of other symptoms within that relevant world. Changes in voice, changes in the endurance to sustain communication, whether in your work environment, in your home environment. These symptoms are more prevalent than people may be aware of. And we're going to hope to demyth and debunk some of that together today.
And that brings me to my next question. What are some of the most common speech disorders that someone with MS might experience?
Absolutely. So I think we can break this down into kind of three large categories that falls within the larger scope of medical speech-language pathology. So first and foremost, speech-language pathologists are individuals who are licensed and certified to diagnose, evaluate, and develop individualized, science-based, so evidence-based practice treatment plans for neurorehabilitation. So within our scope of work, there's three areas that we see that highly correlate to the good work we can do for people living with MS. And that first group, once again, is cognition, where we see that approximate of 30 to 40% of individuals having challenges with cognition, attention, memory, focus, okay, early in their disease course and all throughout the disease course. The second area that we work a lot in is in the area of speech and voice. So changes with speech associated with a acquired neurological condition is a term called dysarthria. And we have a very conservative estimate specifically for dysarthria of about 70% of individuals living with multiple sclerosis. And that third area that we often encounter in our treatment is swallowing, or as you said earlier, dysphagia. Dysphagia means a disruption to the normal swallowing process. And this is a huge area of really needed intervention and better understanding. And we can talk about that later on. And once again, we're looking at conservative estimates of about 43 to 45% of individuals who have difficulty swallowing. And as the disease progresses, we can see upwards to 65% with those who have higher EDSS ratings. So These are the three areas and some of the common numbers that we see in terms of our clinical practice and treatment.
What are some of the more common speech-related symptoms or disorders that MS might create for someone?
Absolutely. So as I just alluded to, dysarthria is a change in speech and voice and respiration associated with neurological dysfunction. So the speech musculature changes as a function of MS. We see changes in the lungs, the vocal cords, the soft palate, the tongue, the lip, and the jaw. And when these changes occur, it can impact the ability for somebody to clearly, concisely, and articulate how they're feeling and what they need to do and impact their work and their social communication. So in short, dysarthria results in reductions in speech intelligibility or one's perceived clarity. And it's so important that we get in there and work and improve upon dysarthria, because dysarthria is one of the leading early causes of isolation and increased depression for individuals with multiple sclerosis.
You just talked about how dysarthria can be worked on. So am I hearing that these kinds of speech-related symptoms can be improved?
Absolutely. So in particular, for persons living with multiple sclerosis, most commonly we see two subtypes of dysarthria. The first type is called spastic dysarthria, which is not surprising because many people with MS experience spasticity, right? This is due to bilateral upper motor neuron dysfunction associated with demyelination. So what happens is that their articulators, the muscles in their mouth, their neck, and even within their ribs, the intercostals, become tight and spastic. And that can create a very harsh, pressed, tight vocal quality and difficulty getting the air that you need to sustain comfortable communication. And the second type that we often see is something called ataxic dysarthria. And this could be as a result of individuals who perhaps have a higher lesion load found in their cerebellum. And our cerebellum is responsible, of course, for the coordination of a lot of our body's muscle movement. So we have patients who experience difficulty with coordinating, neurologically speaking, getting started with their communication and having the rate and the flow or the musicality of their communication as a secondary symptom to multiple sclerosis.
And now let's talk about those cognitive issues you referenced. Can MS-related cognitive issues also be improved?
Absolutely. So we can see improvement. Well, let's take a step back for a second. Some of the changes we see with cognition can be difficulty with sustained attention, memory, often short-term memory or episodic memory, making new memories. We can have difficulty with the speed in which somebody understands information and processes information, which then reduces memory. Because if you didn't really hear and process something, it's hard to hold on to it for the long term or the short term. So these are some of the common symptoms that we see amongst many others. But the rehabilitation of cognition is very similar to dysarthria. There are effective treatments, working with speech language pathology, working with neuropsychology, perhaps in the case of cognition. There are a variety of very strongly evidence-based treatment programs that are personalized to your particular characteristics and challenges with cognition. And once again, the same being for dysarthria, we create individualized treatment plans that targets those areas that warrant change and modification. But we always lead with science. Let me be clear that the world of medical speech pathology is not about, you know, throwing macaroni on the wall and hoping it sticks. Everything we do, we lead with understanding what is the neuropathology, what is the root of this challenge that our patient is facing, and then we treat it with what can we do to change the brain or to change the communication within the brain to improve these symptoms. And that applies to cognition, swallowing, and speech and voice for the world of multiple sclerosis.
What about difficulties related to swallowing? You know, every one of us requires food and water to survive. Swallowing is an important function. So first, what causes difficulties in swallowing for people with MS?
I'm so glad you've asked this. So dysphagia, as we said earlier, is defined simply as difficulty swallowing. The swallowing function can be impaired for persons with MS due to lesions in the cortical bulbar tracts. We see changes in our cranial nerves, once again, changes in the cerebellum and the brainstem. Chewing and swallowing is so deceptively simple when you don't have any challenges in those areas I just mentioned. We can swallow upwards of 1,200 times per day without any thought or really concern for it. But when there is a change to those muscles, when the muscles are weakened or become uncoordinated due to nerve damage secondary to MS, it really impacts the way that the food is managed in our mouth. It interferes with our ability to take in proper oral nutrition. And it really changes your ability to socialize and feel confident eating and drinking in all of the social communication contexts where food is a part of everything. And the changes that we see experience with MS specifically for swallowing could be difficulty just controlling food or liquid in your mouth. Difficulty getting that ball of food, or what we call bolus, started. It's in your mouth, but when it's the time to swallow, you have a little bit of a difficulty with the initiation of moving it into your throat and down to your food tube. And most importantly, patients with multiple sclerosis and individuals living with MS are at a very high occurrence or incidence for aspiration. And aspiration is when food or liquid or any type of saliva or mucus enters the airway instead of the food tube. And this can cause a multitude of challenges in the health world. It can cause upper respiratory infections and ultimately can cause something called aspiration pneumonia, which unfortunately can be deadly.
Are there treatments available to address dysphagia?
Absolutely. So as common as dysphagia really may be, unfortunately, we know only about 6% of persons who have speech and swallowing and cognitive issues related with MS seek treatment. And we're here to demystify and debunk that today, because there's absolutely treatment available. The first thing we do when we introduce ourselves and open up the topic of swallowing difficulty with a patient is to better understand their symptoms. What's happening? What are you reporting? Are there foods you're avoiding, right? Have you lost weight? All of these type of information allows us to do then something called an instrumental exam, where we physically have our patient eat and drink different foods in front of an X-ray machine, right? Called a modified barium swallow study. And myself and the patient together can look and physically watch the ball of food go from the mouth down into the food tube and see where is the disruption and where is the breakdown. So once we have our case history and now we've looked with our own eyes exactly what's happening, we can go in there and create different exercise programs, modify different foods, change position. We can either compensate or physically rehabilitate the swallowing based off the unique symptomology observed in the modified barium swallow study. So there's so much treatment available. If we can just get people to come see people like myself and my colleagues, because that 6% referral rate is something we need to improve for the sake of quality of life.
So how does someone living with MS know that it's time to have their speech and swallowing evaluated?
Okay, so I'm so glad you mentioned this. So just this past June, many of us were at CMSC in Denver this past year, and I was so privileged to be a part of a group of interdisciplinary rehabilitation specialists. And every year we do a series on how do we improve this? How do we know when to refer? And the bottom line is we refer upon diagnosis. The gold standard is to refer upon diagnosis. And there's so many reasons why, and I'll just give you two. The first reason is if we refer upon diagnosis to not just medical speech pathology, but also my occupational therapy and physical therapy colleagues, we can develop as best as possible baseline data. How you are today, soon after initial diagnosis, and determine if there are any areas that require improvement, or do we have now data to see and to measure against change in time. And it seems kind of silly, maybe they don't have any challenges with speech or challenges with ambulation, but should that happen in the future, we know where you were upon diagnosis and we can objectively measure this change. And it's very important, especially when we look at individuals who may ask to go out on disability or have changes associated with their job. we can now quantify and qualify those changes. So initial diagnosis is so and so important. And then we recommend, if it's not upon initial diagnosis, that when you go for your MRI or annual or biannual form of diagnostic testing, that you set yourself up with the triple threat of rehab, PT, SLP, and OT, to once again have a change in time, or to go in there and develop where you are now and see where there could be areas of improvement. Because so much can be done just at home to maintain skills and function that does not require, you know, a twice a week commitment. And you won't know if you can be an active participant in your own MS care unless you at least have a consultation or an initial evaluation with an MS certified specialist.
So I'm going to take this opportunity to stress how important it is for the patient and or their caregiver to speak up at that annual or semi-annual appointment with their neurologist. I can give you an example from my own personal experience. My wife lived with advanced progressive MS. I was her caregiver, and there was an occasion fairly early on in her MS journey where we were at her neurologist's office for a 6-month follow-up. And he asked the classic question, so how's everything going? And she gave her best answer, but she forgot the part where she had choked a few times over the last 6 months, just trying to eat her lunch, eat her breakfast, doing something pretty standard for most of us. And so because I happened to be in the room with her, I said, what about the fact that you're choking more? You know, the thing about getting referred to physical therapy is your neurologist can take a look at you, can watch you do that 25-foot walk, and they're going to recognize that perhaps you might benefit from physical therapy. They can't see you swallow. So it's important to, you know, keep that journal where you record your symptoms that may actually be affecting you maybe a few weeks, even a couple of months before your appointment. So they may not be top of mind. And have those notes with you. Have that caregiver with you who can kind of fill in some of the blanks that you might miss along the way. And as a result of that conversation with her neurologist, she was indeed referred to a specialist to do that barium swallowing evaluation that you just mentioned. So it's so important at those follow-up meetings to be as comprehensive as you can in describing what MS has been like for you, not just over the past few days, but over the past several months since you last saw that neurologist.
Absolutely. You bring up such an important point. When individuals with MS often meet with their primary care provider, whether it be neurologist, advanced nurse practitioner, PA, there's always so much focus, understandably, on the effective interventions and disease-modifying therapies and making sure that we're really having a profound impact on preserving quality of life and slowing down, if not trying to stop, the disease progression. And bravo, I really appreciate that. But often these symptoms that are so important, without having proper nutrition and hydration, you're not going to have the energy to go to work, to participate in your life, to even participate in rehabilitation if you're constantly running on empty. And there's something that's really, really important. And I was always hoping that my PCP provider colleagues would ask more, but this is my arena to do that. You know, when I started the world of multiple sclerosis 18 years ago, there were no oral formulation disease modifying therapies. There were no pills for MS, right? And because pills require safe and effective swallowing, and there are more and more individuals who are seeking out an oral formulation, DMT, every clinician who's prescribing disease-modifying therapies that could potentially be delivered orally needs to be referring for medical speech pathology. I'm going to say it from the rooftops, because those oral formulation pills are not effective sitting in your upper airway. They need to get to the final destination. They need to make it to your stomach. They need to be digested. They need to be metabolized. And if you have your DMT in the wrong pipe, if you will, This is hugely concerning for so many reasons: pneumonia, lack of effectiveness, choking, just really of major concern. So please hear me out and think critically when you talk about swallowing with your provider, especially if you're considering an oral formulation pill.
And everything we've just been talking about really underscores how important it is. And I try to stress this often with my listeners. You need to be a partner in your treatment. I know we like to use the word patient, and that may have slightly different definition in some people's minds, but patients need to be full partners in their treatment, in coming up with treatment plans, in asking for referrals if they are not offered. It's your MS to manage. And the more you can be a participant in all of that, I think the better the outcomes tend to be.
Absolutely. I had the privilege of just about a month ago to speak to a large group of social workers associated with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, specifically on advocacy. And it was such a lovely opportunity to talk about advocacy, because you are a consumer of healthcare, but consumer doesn't mean a backseat driver. It's a partnership. Medicine is a two-way street, and it's a partnership. And if you don't feel like you're having your thoughts, your ideas, your concerns validated by your partner in your care, which is your neurological team, your rehab team, and so many other professions, then that's not a good partnership. Because everything you say and report to your healthcare team warrants investigation and time to see if it's something that can be improved upon or better understood. And that's how we effectively manage any disease, when there's an open and fluid and mutual respect between provider and patient, and that both are equal, and we're not simply just taking the recommendations of the healthcare team, but we're delicately and politely challenging and pushing back to make sure it's the best fit for you and your family. So advocacy is everything as a consumer of healthcare.
You've touched upon answer to this question already, but I wanted to circle back and ask you what a person might expect in working with a speech language pathologist.
Absolutely. I love this question, because there is so much that you can understand and anticipate when you know what's going to happen, right? Knowledge is power. So first and foremost, once again, if you haven't been referred to a medical speech pathologist and you in fact have MS, go ahead and advocate. Ask for that referral, get some data. No matter where you are in your disease course, there's power and knowledge. And then once that referral is made, you will have an appointment with somebody like myself, and we will ask very specific questions in those three arenas of cognition, speech and voice, and swallowing. And based off of some case history type of anecdotal information, we will then develop a customized formal battery of assessments. We have a lot of different validated and normed reference assessment tools that allow us to measure how your cognition is compared to similar age-like educational peers. And we can measure that difference if there is one. And once again, quantify and qualify. The same for voice and speech. We know exactly what your breath support should be given your age and gender. We know exactly how fast your articulators should be able to move as an adult. We'll take that data and compare it to norms. And the same for swallowing. By being able to have the test in front of the X-ray machine using barium, we can physically see what falls within the scope of normal and what may be deviant from that. And those three areas of investigation, which could take approximately, I would say, minimally three good diagnostic sessions, will give you everything you need to best understand your disease and areas of potential improvement to then create a personalized intervention plan.
Dr. Marissa Barrera, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
I'm so appreciative of this opportunity. Thank you very much.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/309. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.